From McMinnville, Oregon, this is Crisscrossing Science, the podcast with ants and his plants. I'm Michael Crosser, with me is Chad Tilburg, and today's title is Myrmecophytes. Hey, Chad.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
I'm doing all right.
Good.
So what are we talking about today?
Well, we had a recent conversation with Jeremy Weiss.
And yes, we did.
We spoke about some of his research on sponges and the mutualistic relationship that many sponges have with bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And that just got me to thinking about other kinds of symbioses. And one of the kinds of symbiosis that I happen to be familiar with is the relationship between plants and ants.
So listeners may not be fully aware of this. We have your bio somewhere on Facebook.
Do we? I don't know.
I don't know if we do.
I don't know.
So if listeners may not be familiar with this, your expertise is in ants.
In fact, yeah. And so I actually did my PhD studying an ant plant symbiosis. So something that I...
In Argentina.
This was in Costa Rica. And so this was, you know, a while back, I spent a fair bit of my time kind of reading and thinking about these kinds of systems.
Mm.
So I have a deep and abiding love for ant plant mutualisms.
Hmm.
They're so cool.
All right. Well, let's get into that then.
All right. And you use this complicated word, myrmecophyte.
Yes.
Myrmecophyte?
I hope I said it correctly.
Yeah, then yes.
I've been practicing.
Good. So the fight part,
yeah,
P-H-Y-T-E, that simply means plant. So
the fighting plants.
Yeah. No, you're confusing things. And so the myrmeco part, that is the Greek for ant. Myrmecophyte is just ant plant.
All right.
So ants as a group, ants are often the most abundant and biomassive group of any animal in a particular ecosystem. So ants are a really important group to know something about.
Wait, what do you mean biomass?
So the biomass is just the mass of the living things in an area.
So you're saying if we were on a desert island.
We don't even need to be on a desert island. If you categorized all of the living things into their type of organism,
mm-hmm,
and then weighed them up, ants as a group often are on the order of the total biomass of certain mammal groups. That's just all to say that there are lots and lots of ants. We frequently don't see them mostly because they're so small. And
so, but you're saying there are hundreds of pounds of ants
in
any ecosystem?
Yeah. Depending on the size of the area that you are measuring, there are lots and lots of ants.
Hmm.
So they're incredibly, incredibly abundant as a group.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just a plug for why one ought to be interested in ants generally, I suppose.
Oh, so we're not going to be talking about the, when we went camping and you squeezed the ant and you're like, this poop that is tasty.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can bring that up if you want.
But that's not a myrmecophyte.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Well, there's an interesting thing, and we can maybe talk about this a little bit. The general phenomenon of ants foraging arboreally is all over the planet, including up here in the temperate zone.
Okay.
And up here, ants are doing all kinds of things, from being predators on other insects to foraging up in trees. And if you've ever had a garden or anything like that, then chances are good that you've got aphids on some of your plants. And if you just kind of like bring out a chair and sit there and watch those aphids for long enough,
you might see them reproduce asexually.
You might see them reproduce asexually. That's true.
Because they might have listened to our podcast.
Yeah. Like, wait, we're supposed to do what? Oh, no. And a lot of people are familiar with this little excretion that aphids and other similar kinds of insects have called honeydew. Basically, this is just the liquidy poop coming out the back end of an aphid, and it's basically just concentrated sugar solution.
Hmm.
And many kinds of ants really, really like that. And so they will come and drink this honeydew out of the back end of an aphid.
Last year we went camping with some students and you did this trick. You did this party trick. You grabbed some ants that had stolen some of this honeydew from some aphids.
Uh-huh.
And you put it on your finger and you had us all taste.
So I squeezed it.
Yeah.
And then it, out of its mouth, I made it regurgitate this little droplet of clear liquid.
And the fact that you said it came out of their mouth made me be like, oh, okay, sure, I can. But I didn't realize, I don't know that I recognized that this whole pathway
Before that, it had come out of the butt of it had come out of the butt of an aphid.
I wish you hadn't told me that. No. Yeah. It was very sweet liquid, as you said. Yeah.
Yeah. So a few people tasted it. So anyway, that if you're in the temperate zone, that might be the most common kind of ant-plant interaction that you see.
That the ants are getting food from the aphids, which are getting food from the plant.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And also in the temperate zone, there are some flowering plants that have these additional little glands somewhere on the plant body that produces a sugary secretion itself that the ants will go and they'll drink this little sugary secretion. And in both cases, what this tends to do is that it attracts ants to the plant. And when ants are kind of walking over the surface of the plant, that can have a deterrent effect on herbivores.
Mm. Wait, so you're saying that a plant might have a reason to basically feed the ants because it would prefer to have ants eating little droplets of things that it's secreting out rather than a deer coming through and just munching off entire branches or something like that.
So ants probably will not be deterring deer, but generally what we're thinking in terms of is insect herbivores that might be deterred by the presence of ants.
So these insects, like locusts or,
caterpillars
or
little leaf-feeding beetles, that kind of insect.
So they'd come, they would eat all the leaves of a plant.
Yeah.
And that is more problematic than just little secretions.
Yeah, maybe making a little secretion. Like if you're an herbivorous insect, a good place to feed is someplace that's not really visited much by ants, because ants tend to, they tend to be pretty omnivorous. And if they come across an herbivore that's easy to subdue and take back to the nest as food, they might opportunistically do that.
Mm.
And so just the presence of ants being around often has a deterrent effect on herbivorous insects. So anyway, in the tropics, there are lots and lots of examples of plants that have independently evolved this strategy of producing these hollow cavities that the ants will nest inside of. And the plants will produce these hollow cavities whether the ants are there or not. So it's not like the ants arrive and hollow out a stem or something, or the ants arrive and induce the plant to produce this hollow cavity. If you experimentally restrict access of ants to the plant will go ahead and produce these hollow cavities. So they're this evolved feature that specific kinds of ants have co-evolved the ability to identify those features and gain access to these little hollow cavities, and they nest inside them.
So normally when I think of an ant, I'm thinking of this little pile of dirt where the whole nest is someplace.
Uh-huh.
And you're saying that, yes, there are those ants, but there's a lot of different types of ants in the world.
Indeed.
And so these particular ants do not live in the ground like that. They are living in these hollow spaces in plant.
Right. And especially in the tropics, where the vast majority of the biomass is above ground, there are many, many, many species that never even go to the ground. Their entire existence is arboreal.
Hmm.
And so they're nesting up there, they're foraging up there, they're finding love up there. Sorry, you can cut that.
Nope.
Great. So anyway, these hollow cavities might be different plant features, like they might just be the stems of the plants are hollow.
Okay.
And so you can imagine the entire internal structure of the plant is just like a whole bunch of hollow straws that the ants could move around inside the plant from anywhere to anywhere else inside the plant.
Hmm.
A cool example of that is a tree called Cecropia. You can find that in the tropics. And another strategy is to have a whole bunch of individual little cavities. So like thorns, for example, rather than being just solid tissue, might be hollow. Or do you know what the petiole of a leaf is? You're familiar with the idea of a leaf.
Yes.
And the part of the leaf that looks kind of like a tiny little stem that attaches it to the branch.
Right. Okay.
That's the petiole. And in certain species, that petiole is either swollen and hollow or sort of rolled up in a way that it makes a hollow cavity on the inside of it.
Hmm.
Others will have tubers that are hollowed out. The point is that because this strategy has arisen numerous times in many different plant genera, it's not surprising that we see different parts of the plant where these hollow structures have been formed.
Hmm.
So that's the most defining feature of a myrmecophyte, is having some hollow structure where the ants live.
And not just for traveling. So the stem of the leaf part.
The petiole?
The petiole. They're not living there. That's just a pathway that they can get to other things.
No, in that case, in the case of the hollow petiole, they are living there. It forms like one of their individual little domiciles. And so every single leaf on the plant could very well be inhabited by a different portion of the same ant colony. So you've got an entire ant colony with typically one queen, and she'll be in one of those petioles somewhere.
Hmm.
She'll be cranking out eggs, and the workers will be foraging on the surface of the plant, moving eggs and larvae around, feeding the larvae. Maybe occasionally the queen will move from one petiole to another petiole, but all the ants are then descendant from that single queen. So they are one big colony. They're just distributed throughout the plant in all of these individual little domiciles. So that's the living situation. And in many cases, in most cases, the ants have entirely given up the ability to nest anywhere else. They can no longer nest in the ground. I mean, they probably couldn't even nest in just a random hollow twig or something. They have to have that very specific nesting habitat. So from the plant's perspective, it is creating all of this housing.
Mm-hmm.
And what it now has is this standing army of defenders against herbivores. And so if you're ever in the tropics and you encounter an ant plant, if you sort of tap on the trunk or grab a leaf and sort of shake a branch around,
mm-hmm.
pretty quickly you will see ants just pouring out of the entrances to all of those little domatia and running towards the source of that disturbance.
Hmm.
And it's really fun to do if you are into that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you leave your hand there, depending on the kind of ant you're talking about, you might get stung up. So
yeah, and that doesn't sound like so much fun.
No, it's not. Or, I mean, not all of them are stinging ants. Some will just bite you. But mm-hmm. you can get a whole bunch of little tiny biting ants all over your hand.
Well, and I remember a few years ago, I captured some ants for you because I was like pulling weeds in my sidewalk and I disturbed the nest. And
uh-huh.
they were like crawling all over me. And then at some point I was like, ooh, that itches in this. Ah!
Uh-huh.
And I shook them all off. And then after just a few minutes, all of a sudden like my skin just was burning all over.
I shouldn't laugh.
Oh, it was terrible.
Yeah.
And then I went in, I took a shower and I felt a little bit better. And then kind of went away, and then like an hour or two later, it just like flared up again all of a sudden, and it was terrible.
Yeah.
And you were like, oh yeah, no, that's just a pavement ant or something like that. And I was like, no, these are, no, I promise you. And I brought you some samples, and you're like, yeah, no, that's run of the mill. That's what ants do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so these were not even like fire ants or things that you've heard of.
No,
this is
no.
just a normal ant.
Yeah.
Made my skin just like burn.
Yeah. We don't even have fire ants up here in Oregon yet, but it can be unpleasant. Yeah, and so you can imagine being like a little juicy caterpillar or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
It would not take a whole lot of interactions with ants to dissuade you from being on that plant, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so if the ants, when they're out just kind of patrolling the surface of the plant, if they find a caterpillar or some other herbivore actually feeding on the plant,
mm-hmm.
sometimes they will attack it. And if they are a stinging ant, they might start stinging it.
Mm.
Other times, it's possible that they will kill it and eat it. Or it's possible that they will simply just chase it away, take it over to the edge of the leaf and just drop it off.
Like walking the plank.
Yeah, right.
And you swim with the fishes.
Yeah. So the plant is getting defended from herbivores.
Hmm. But I know you hate when I ask questions like this, but what are the ants thinking in that case, though? Are they just like, we might be able to just eat this caterpillar?
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds tasty and something that I could imagine the ants wanting to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to imagine that they're like, I need to protect this plant.
So ants, being colony livers, are very fastidious. They're very hygienic inside their colony.
Hmm.
And so one of the behaviors that they already do is sort of a hygienic behavior where they will pick up something that isn't supposed to be there and go and move it somewhere. Like if you pay close attention to some of these little conical piles of soil that you mentioned a little bit ago, occasionally you might find like another little pile of just refuse. Or some ant nests, if you dig them up, there'll be, you know, all the chambers where they have the larvae and that kind of stuff. And then another chamber will be their midden pile where they keep all their trash. And so it's not weird for ants to recognize something and behave in a way where they're like, this is not supposed to be here. So they pick it up and take it and chuck it somewhere else.
Hmm. Okay.
It's probably not crossing their little ant brain that, oh, I should do this for the sake of the plant.
Right.
Right. So in addition to, we talked a little bit about how ants get food resources from plants in lots of different kinds of ecosystems. Mm-hmm. And that's also very common in these actual myrmecophytes. In many cases, it's even more developed. For example, some ant plants will have these little glands called extrafloral nectaries where they're cranking out sugary solutions. Or they'll make these little things called food bodies, which are little tiny things maybe at the tip of a leaf. And these food bodies are really nutritionally interesting because they're really high in fat, also tend to be high in protein. So they are these really highly adapted, fatty, protein-rich morsels for the ants to consume. And so a lot of these ants don't really even need to actually eat the herbivores that they find on the plant occasionally because they get a complete balanced diet from their host plant.
Interesting.
Other things that the ants will do for the plant, in some of them, if a vine starts to attach to a branch, the ants will often go and just cut that thing off, just prune it off. And so it keeps the host plant free of lots of other things growing on it. There are some, like in acacia species from the Central America region will often have ants that live in them that will actually go down the trunk of the tree to the ground into the surrounding leaf litter, and they will prune any new germinating seedlings. And so what you end up with are these little discs of cleared ground around the host plant, which keeps that host plant from having to deal with any competitors, which is pretty cool. Having been in a lot of these habitats before, it's just fun to like go and get a little blade of grass or something and lay it across a branch of one of these ant plants and just sit there and watch as the ants come out and find it and start getting all worked up and then start using their mandibles to try to chew it off. And it's a good afternoon.
So actually, what do you do when you go beyond just messing with the ants? What would be a typical day when we're doing your research?
Okay. Well, what I was interested in, I was studying this plant called Cordia alliodora. And what I found is that an individual tree tends to be mostly inhabited by one particular species of ant.
Okay.
But what I started noticing is that if you look at the entire tree, there would be these little neighborhoods within the tree where a few of the domatia were inhabited by somebody else, by a different ant species. What I was interested in is, how does the identity of the ant species affect the nature of the interaction between the ants and the plant? And so I would do field experiments where I would look at things like foraging behavior of the different ants and aggressive behavior of the different ants to kind of try to quantify how effective of a defender that ant species was.
And so you said it's fun to lay a leaf on there, but that would actually be part of an experiment?
Well, in this case, what I put like little simulated herbivores on a leaf and then would do things like time how long it was until discovery, and once it was discovered, what were the recruitment behaviors of the different ant species.
What does recruitment behavior mean?
One of the things that many ants do when a worker is out foraging and it finds a food resource is it might take a little bit of that food resource and then run back to the nest. And while it is heading back to the nest, it might be laying down a little scent trail. And then a few minutes later, a whole bunch of workers from that nest will follow that scent trail out to the resource. And so this is a really good way for an ant colony to bring back, in a very efficient way, a large resource. So if you've ever, like, a lot of people have had like sugar ants in their kitchen, right?
And it is fun on the counter to like smear the trail that they make.
Yeah, exactly. They'll be like totally lost or something for a while. And then, yeah. And so they're basically following a little scent trail. And so what I found is that for the Azteca ants, they would, number one, they would find a simulated caterpillar pretty rapidly. And number two, they would recruit really vigorously.
And would you do this on different leaves on the same plant or different plants? Or
both. But then these other ant species that I was talking about that live in the same tree, I would give kind of in their neighborhood the opportunity to forage, but they would take forever to find this simulated caterpillar. So they're very low frequency foragers. When they did rarely find one of the simulated caterpillars, they would never recruit. So they're very ineffectual foragers. So that was a lot of the experimental field work I did. And then I did a whole bunch of collections to try to apportion how much of the tree was occupied by the what seems to be a mutualistic ant versus how much of the tree was occupied by what appears to be a parasite of this mutualism. And then I should describe the system, I suppose. It's this relatively fast-growing tree.
All right.
You can imagine there's a branch, and then there's what's called a node. It's a branching point, basically.
Okay, sure.
And so typically at each of these branching points, there would be four or five branches that kind of go off at angles, and then one main branch that kind of continues sort of straight on. And then that would come to another node, right? And then each of these ones that goes off at an angle, that then eventually will have a node, which will then kind of branch,
so on
and so forth, right? And so that's kind of the structure of the tree, right? It's all of these nodes with branches arising. And so that's kind of the general growth pattern of this genus. And in this particular species, those nodes were hollow. And so that's where the domatia were.
Okay.
And so if you cut those open, that's where you would find all of the ants nesting. You'd find eggs and larvae and a lot of workers. And then on the inside of the wall of the domatia, you would find these tiny little brownish dots. And those were scale insects, were these little honeydew-producing insects. In this case, the plant doesn't produce food bodies or extrafloral nectar itself, but secondarily, the ants are getting a plant resource as honeydew.
Similar to what we talked about earlier.
Yeah. And so that's all to say.
But it has special caverns. These nodes are special caverns where whatever that other insect is located.
Yeah. And it's probably the case that the ants are moving them in there.
Oh.
Because the plant's like growing always, right? Always producing new nodes. And the ants are sort of always moving up and into the new nodes. It would not surprise me, though I never actually directly observed it. It would not surprise me if the ants are moving scale insects into these newly opened nodes. So anyway, this is all to sort of set the stage for the next part of the study, which was what are the ants eating? What are their main diet resources? So I used this technique called stable isotope analysis. And without getting too much into the weeds about how that works, what it allows you to do is to apportion different dietary components in an animal's diet. And by doing that, what I found is that the Azteca ants, the ones that were really diligent foragers and discovered caterpillars rapidly, and I have, you know, all of these little picture series of them killing and taking apart caterpillars, they get a large part of their diet from actually consuming insects on the surface of the plant, as well as at least some of their diet from the honeydew.
Right, because this technique, we won't get into the details, but this technique allows you to tell if they're eating mostly plant or mostly animal products.
That's right. Yeah. So in this case, it allowed me to distinguish between do they have a plant-based diet or do they have at least some animal material in their diet.
Now, have you cut open humans to do the same analysis, like a vegetarian or a vegan?
Can we talk about that later? I haven't cut them open, but but we can talk about that.
Oh, that's actually cool. Okay, but we have a title here, so we need to stick with.
Yeah. So then getting back to these other ants that I mentioned are really lousy foragers, and it turns out that it looks like they get almost all of their diet is plant-based.
Now, are they also in a node?
Yeah, so they're occupying the nodes.
And so I would imagine there's a fight for a new node opens.
Yeah, that's a
like
great question.
Walmart on Thanksgiving. Walmart on Black Friday.
Yeah, right. So the way these trees get colonized, and this is, I think, generally pretty common for a lot of myrmecophytes, ant plants, is when a new plant germinates and grows up into a little sapling, this relationship with the ants has to be reestablished every generation for the plant. And so what happens is the plant starts producing whatever feature it is that is the domatia, and new queen ants that are dispersing away from some other colony, striking out to try to establish their own colony, will find and start to colonize these newly opened domatia. And so in a young sapling myrmecophyte, you might actually have numerous new little incipient colonies, ant colonies, all arising from a different queen. And then there's really strong selection on those ants to have colonies that grow quickly. Then they start going to war with each other. And eventually you end up with a tree that will be occupied by just one colony.
Okay.
So that's all to say that these ants are very, very possessive of their host plant. And so your question is, how is it that this other ant species is able to make a living there is a really great one. And this particular ant that I'm thinking of has two worker morphologies, two worker castes. They have the smaller one that kind of does the nest work that needs to be done. The smaller one is also the one you might find out foraging from time to time. And that's what most of the workers look like. But in each node, they might have one or maybe two larger workers. And on the top of these larger workers' heads, they have this flattened disc. I mean, it looks sort of like a dinner plate just right on top of their head. And it also is the size and shape of the little tiny opening that they chew into the node, their entrance. And so when nobody is passing through the entrance, the one and only job of these workers is to basically plug the entrance with the top of their head. And it's really kind of cool when you see it, because you see the entrance and there's like a little tiny gray disc there blocking that entrance. And if you look really closely, you might see the tips of the antennae of this ant kind of just barely peeking out. And if you watch it for a while, a little forager might come back and they'll smell, sniff each other. And the large worker that's blocking the entrance will sort of back out of the way, and the worker will move into the nest, and then it'll plug the entrance again. So that's how they defend themselves, is they have a really effective way of blocking their nest entrance.
Interesting.
And so in this case, the main colony, the Azteca, just can't gain access to them. One of the cool things that I always think about when I'm thinking about mutualisms is how they might be prone to exploitation. Maybe I should have defined this at the beginning, but when we're thinking about a mutualism, we're thinking about a situation where one individual is incurring some cost, but that cost is more than made up for as a result of the interaction with some other organism. And the same is true of that second organism. It's incurring some cost, but that cost is more than made up for as a result of interaction with the first organism, right? So there's this reciprocal mutual benefit, but both are investing at least some cost. And you can imagine in the case of the plant, it's not free to make these food bodies. Those are costly. Producing extra floral nectar might be costly. Producing the domatia might be costly. But that's more than made up for by having this standing army of defenders.
And so it's better to have a bunch of ants than it is to have a bunch of caterpillars, because the ants are getting a little bit of sugar here and there. They're not affecting the leaves, which are the production sites for a lot of that food.
Right. As a plant, even if you're having to invest, say, 5% of your biomass into producing these things that benefit the ants, if you didn't do that, you would lose more than that as a result of herbivory. So it pencils out that it's a net benefit to incur that cost, because the benefit is even higher. And then from the perspective of the ants, they obviously are getting the benefits of all of these things from the plant, a place to live, food. But a cost to them evolutionarily might be that they have given up the ability to live anywhere else. So they're really stuck. They probably couldn't even live in just a hollow twig anymore. You know, they wouldn't recognize it as the appropriate nesting habitat. If their plant is not there, neither are they. So anyway, when you have this kind of situation where these potential benefits are being produced, is that many of these ant plants might be parasitized. That's what I described with those other ants that have the little dinner plate on their heads. Right? They would be a parasite of this mutualism. They're reaping the benefits of living there. They're getting 100% of their resources from plant-based resources, but they are really lousy plant defenders.
Very cool stuff.
It was kind of fun to get back into thinking about this again.
Well, good.
Yeah, maybe we've talked about doing some traveling podcasts or something. We should do one from Costa Rica.
From Costa Rica?
Yeah, an update to this episode.
Well, you know, stamps.com.
Yeah.
We need to start doing advertising.
We should just include ads and then start sending them a bill.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an idea. We'll have to look into that.
Yeah.
But this episode of Crisscrossing Science was recorded in the KSLC studios on the beautiful campus of Linfield College. Rody Ortega wrote our theme music. Like us on Facebook to see what we're up to. We also have links to a file system called Digital Commons, in which you can find older episodes that are no longer available around. Subscribe to this podcast and you will get the latest episode as soon as it becomes available. While there, leave a rating and a comment, and that will help other people find this podcast in the future. Until next time, thanks for listening.